You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Rachel Shabi, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Rachel, what do you have for us this morning?
Good morning. This morning we're going to be talking about whether Egypt has changed its relationship status with the US to not exclusive. And we're looking at France pouring a bucket of ice cold water over the Iran talks.
And ice cold it is here in November in London. Meanwhile, the Commonwealth Summit later this week has sparked controversy over its rather warmer location, Sri Lanka. We'll ask if the event should be boycotted and whether there's any point in having the heads of Commonwealth meet anyway.
We'll also head to Paratissima, the fringe event to Turin's contemporary art fair, Artitissima.
We are trying to transform in an organized chaos from a chaos. We want to help the artists to understand what is best for their artworks.
And we'll find out whether the screenwriters behind the Israeli TV series hit that inspired Homeland have any new blockbuster shows up their sleeve.
It's a family drama about this extremely talented kid, an extremely talented musician, but the parents find out that he's autistic, and it's how they deal with it.
All that, plus we play some music as well, and we'll also be flicking through this morning's Brazilian front pages. It's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So we have a jam-packed show this morning, but at 8.02, let's catch up first on the news headlines from around the world with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. An international relief effort is underway to help hundreds of thousands of people in the Philippines who've been displaced by a powerful typhoon. It's estimated the storm killed 10,000 people, and the United Nations says many survivors have no food, water, or medicine. Relief operations have been hampered by the devastation caused, with some officials likening the destruction to the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. Kasiyuko Yamazaki is from the World Food Programme, which is ready to get aid to one of the worst hit cities, Tacloban.
We are prepared to send the relief items when we have a request. And especially we're expecting the order from ASEAN. So we have a family kits and the family tents and for their stocks. So as soon as we receive an order, so we can dispatch either Philippines or Vietnam.
Typhoon Haiyan has now hit land in Vietnam. Six people are reported to have died and dozens injured, but the storm has weakened substantially since hitting the Philippines. Authorities have moved thousands of people to safe zones. The Western-backed Syrian opposition has agreed to take part in international peace talks in Geneva, but the Syrian National Coalition says there are conditions that must be met before the talks, including a demand that any conference should result in political transition. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has previously refused to meet any preconditions. And Shawshank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute told Monocle 24 that many hurdles still remain before peace is achieved.
It is good news, given that the coalition had previously said it would not attend. But I would put this in context. First of all, it's far from clear that the conditions of the coalition will be met, particularly the condition that Assad play no part in any transitional government. The Russians in particular don't support that particular condition.
Maldives police have clashed with hundreds of protesters after outgoing President Mohamed Wahid said he would remain in power after his term ended, defying the opposition-led parliament and throwing the country deeper into crisis. He was due to step down on Sunday, but a runoff in the presidential election was postponed until Saturday, leaving the Indian Ocean archipelago in constitutional limbo. Mohamed Nasheed won Saturday's first vote, but fell short of the 50% needed to win power, and the Supreme Court delayed the second vote until this weekend. World governments are beginning a meeting in Poland aimed at reaching a 2015 deal to fight climate change. But concern over economic growth is likely to outweigh scientists' warnings of rising temperatures. Organisers hope countries will agree limits on emissions of greenhouse gases with a mechanism to compare and strengthen them over time. Environmentalists warned about the dangers of delaying action to avert more floods, heatwaves and rising sea levels. A capsule has touched down in Kazakhstan, returning to Earth the Olympic torch for the Sochi 2014 Winter Games. It was brought back by a crew of three from the International Space Station. During its four-day journey, the torch was taken on its first ever spacewalk. The flame on the torch had to be extinguished during its visit to the ISS. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26.
From London,
London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It is 11:06 in Nairobi. It's 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Time now to set the day's news agenda. Joining us now in the studio is Rachel Shabi, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Welcome to the program. Rachel, we were so close, or at least many of us thought we were so close to a deal with Iran. But it looks like no go.
Most of all, the Iranians who, you know, were up all night thinking that there was going to be a deal, that sanctions, which are very crippling on Iran, were going to be eased. And suddenly it all gets turned upside down with France storming in and saying, no, we don't agree. We don't want this. This is foolish, rushed, and we think we should pause it. So that just turned everything upside down.
And there's been sort of outrage and uproar and disbelief that it's France who have played this part. Some Iranians suggesting that France should perhaps now replace the US as le grand Satan, or Satan. I mean, where did this come from, and why France, why have they acted in this way, do you think?
Yeah, it is, as you say, been completely surprising that this has happened at such a late stage. And not just the fact that France did it, but the way they did it. You know, the whole point of these negotiations was to build confidence. Obviously, the first time that these nations have spoken, US and Iran haven't spoken since 79, and now they've been speaking for 72 hours consecutively. So, you know, this kind of intense meetings was and the deal was designed to build confidence. And France revealing the details of that deal to the press was just absolutely, that's exactly what you don't do in that situation. So that in part explains the fury of the rest of the players in that game, that they've not only trashed it, but they've kind of done it in such a public and unconstructive way.
And we saw an unexpected visit by Secretary of State John Kerry to Geneva during the talks. Do we get a sense of how annoyed or frustrated perhaps the Americans are with this? Because, of course, if there was some sort of a deal, this would be a rather large achievement, I guess, for the Obama administration.
Yeah, I think you can see how annoyed the U.S. is and the kind of statements that the US is making. First of all, the US is very annoyed with Israel. Obama specifically said to Netanyahu, look, I don't want you going and talking to all the other players in this game and trying to put them off. It's now been revealed that he did exactly that. And he did talk to Germany, to Britain and to France and try to put pressure on them to scupper the deal on his behalf. So that's one source. And the other thing is that, you know, John Kerry has said, look, we're not stupid and we're not blind. We know what we're doing. We're not trying to damage our interests, much less the interests of our allies, Israel and Saudi. So you can see, I think, in the statements that he's making that have been really quite frank, that there is huge annoyance coming from the US.
And he has made the point that there is still scepticism about Iran's willingness to dismantle the nuclear program. Sanctions will still be there, as you say, or as he said, you know, it wasn't just a kind of complete letting down of all of these former reservations. No surprise then that many of these, particularly the ultra-conservative factions in Iran, describing Laurent Fabius as the servant of the Zionist regime. I mean, presumably this just will rumble on in terms of the standoff between Israel and Iran and bringing everyone else into the fray.
Yeah, completely. I mean, that's the thing that everybody immediately assumes, that France is basically doing Israel's work
bidding.
On its behalf, doing its bidding, or certainly is moving in that direction. And France, you know, it has a particular game to play in the Middle East. It has been allied more with Gulf countries in the past few years. We can see that from its position on Syria and its actions in Libya, that it has been much more closely allied to a kind of Saudi Arabia GCC position. And of course, those countries are the ones that are opposed to any kind of Iran deal. So you can see France, I mean, its concerns may or may not be valid. It doesn't sound like they are. It sounds like they have been addressed in the negotiations. But in any case, it is trying to play a role that it's based on its own interests
as
well.
Are we back to square one then?
We could be. Or, I mean, it could be solvable. I mean, the groups are set to meet on the 20th of November, and it could be that in that time, it's not that far away, that they will actually take France's objection and dismiss it and deal with it and say, look, this isn't really the big deal that France makes out, and force France to then say, well, no, you're right, it isn't. So it might actually, I mean, some commentators have said, well, maybe it's a good thing that they've actually exposed this thing. They are objecting to a reactor that has potential nuclear connotations in the future. But it could be a good thing in the long run. It could be that it has forced this issue to the fore and, you know, preempted any kind of hurdle that might be met further down the line.
Rachel, let's move over to Egypt. It's less than a month since Egypt publicly condemned that American decision to suspend portions of its military aid package. But now relations seem to be back on track, despite the fact that Egypt was sort of potentially reaching out to other partners such as Russia. How much can we trust that the relationship really is back on track? And what does it mean if it is?
Well, I think, you know, we saw John Kerry make a very friendly visit to Egypt last week when he was very keen to assure Egyptians that everything was fine. You know, hey, we're great. The relationship's great. Everything's back on track. But it's quite interesting seeing the statements coming out of Egypt, especially the foreign minister, Nabil Fahmy, who said over the weekend, yeah, it might be fine with the US. That's okay. But, you know, we're not tied to them. It's not an exclusive relationship, basically. We're free to see other people. And they have started to make overtures to Russia and see what the potential is there. And it seems like it could be that Egypt is shifting into more independence in its foreign policy and its alliances, meaning that it will, you know, form alliances wherever they are and not choose one against the other.
And what's in it for Russia?
Well, again, Russia, I mean, it has its own weight to punch in the Middle East, and it's very keen to build alliances in that region. And that relationship for the US is important, not just in terms of maintaining US stability in the region, but it's also, you know, it gives the US priority, military and trade priority through the Suez Canal, which is a very important route. So it's not just the kind of stability security issue there. There are trade and geopolitical strengths that are to be gained from having that relationship with Egypt. And I'm sure Russia has its eyes on that. Russia was a very close ally of Egypt before the 79 peace deal with Egypt between Israel and Egypt that drove Egypt into the sort of US-Israel camp.
But could Russia get anywhere close to the $1.5 billion in aid that America offers?
It might. It might. I mean, we look at the sort of Gulf countries and the huge amounts of money that they have pledged to Egypt following the coup. I mean, it's really become apparent following that coup. I think for Egypt, it was a real wake up call in terms of, OK, we really can't trust anybody. We thought these guys were on our side, now they're not. And no, it turns out these guys who we thought hated us do like us. And I think it's been very much, you know, what's coming out of the foreign ministry in Egypt now is very much, well, we'll just do our own thing. And if we think that this is going to be to our advantage, then we'll take it. And if it isn't, then we won't. And that,
trust no one.
Yeah, and that is a shift.
Excellent stuff, Rachel. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Rachel Shabi, many thanks as always, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands.
Coming up, we'll be asking whether the Commonwealth still holds any value.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
It's 16:16 in Taipei, 10:16 in Cairo, 8:16 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This week, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting will take place in Sri Lanka. The event has attracted widespread controversy, not for its goals, namely to agree on collective policies and initiatives, but because of its location. Sri Lanka, shall we say, is not exactly known for being the Commonwealth member that is most respectful of human rights.
The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and his Canadian counterpart Stephen Harper have already announced they will be boycotting the event. Well, should other heads of state follow their lead? And what's the point of the event anyways? Well, to discuss this further, we're joined in the studio by Martin Plaut, a fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Martin, how big of a surprise is it that Manmohan Singh will not be there at this meeting?
That is quite a surprise. It reflects pressures on him from some of his allies in the south of India, because that is where the Tamil parties basically come from. And it hasn't been universally well received. I mean, the Times of India has been writing saying they're not very keen on the idea, and why should he be dumping the Commonwealth for a regional advantage, political advantage? I mean, the big problem, of course, in Sri Lanka is that you have all of these tea plantations, which were basically, run and worked by the Tamils from India, and the Sri Lankans, who are essentially Sinhalese and Buddhists, essentially didn't think they are Sri Lankans, and they hated them. And this is a terrible endemic problem, which led to the LTTE and the Tamil Tigers. But how does one get around that? And that has been the underlying problem in this whole issue for years and years.
There's been widespread calls from other leaders of other countries or other representatives of other countries, namely Australia, that a further boycott should be taking place. There is, of course, a counter-argument that says actually a boycott will further isolate Sri Lanka and that's not the way to tackle it. What are your thoughts on that, Martin?
Well, that is exactly the position that Kamala Sharma, the Secretary-General of the Commonwealth, puts out. He says, no, look, we're a family, we can deal with this in the family. And that is very, very much the way that the Commonwealth now sees itself. We do things behind the scenes. We can always have influence, but we don't put it out there and have a huge fight. Is that a suitable thing to be saying? Well, not really, because, in March this year, the Commonwealth signed an agreement. All the heads of government, stepped up to this and said that they would respect human rights, the whole range of human rights. But then, of course, when you begin saying, well, what about your country? Well, then they begin to back off. And there has been a big move, to try and get a greater boycott of the Commonwealth. But for the other reason, which is that people like the Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya wants people to boycott it because of the pressure that is on him to stand before the International Criminal Court. So he's trying to drag that in as well. But it doesn't seem to be working.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned there the Commonwealth trying to fight for these human rights. Well, when you look at kind of a new report that was just released today from Amnesty saying that something like 80% of Commonwealth countries have anti-gay laws in place, what does that say about a Commonwealth, a family that's supposed to be fighting for human rights, when you have a startling figure like that?
Well, yes, I suppose, the problem is that, in reality, you know, something like gay rights is a massive issue in, shall we say, developed countries. In most developing countries, it is still seen as not an issue. And, you know, I'm not arguing the rights or wrongs of it, but that is the way it is. Now, I mean, you know, the Kenyans are saying that Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, Nigeria and South Africa are all going to be staying away at a head of states level. But I noticed this morning that Jacob Zuma from South Africa says, no, he's going. So there is no unity on what they should be doing. And as I say, the Commonwealth is strongest when it works behind the scenes. But that does mean you have these unsatisfactory compromises. But of course, this is by no means the biggest crisis the Commonwealth has faced. That was over apartheid in South Africa, another huge human rights issue, and they survived that. If they can survive that, frankly, I don't think this is such a big issue.
So what is going to be top of the agenda? What are the biggest issues?
Well, I mean, the issues that are the ones that will always be in the Commonwealth, which is essentially cooperation. How can they cooperate with each other and try and do something for each other? And this is where the Commonwealth is enormously powerful. You have, shall we say, an Indian vet coming to Tanzania to advise on problems with a particular disease. Now, at those kind of levels, the Commonwealth works incredibly well. At trying to resolve these huge, international issues, it's not the forum. It doesn't work particularly well. Yes, they can occasionally agree on something, but that is not going to be where the major developments are. It's going to be a very, very difficult conference for Mahinda Rajapaksa, you know, the president of Sri Lanka. I mean, he is going to find this uncomfortable. I mean, you know, there are 40,000 people who died in the last few years in Sri Lanka during the war. That is going to be a tough one for him. It's also a tough one, of course, for all the royal family, because although the Queen is not going for the first time in many, many years, she is represented by Prince Charles. And that photograph of Prince Charles shaking hands with someone who is seen by many human rights critics as a mass murderer, or being responsible for mass murder, is going to be a terribly difficult one for the royal family to live down.
And you describe the Commonwealth as being a family. Of course, one of those family members pulled out just last month. Gambia pulled out of the Commonwealth, saying that it was an extension of neocolonialism. Does this family still hold value in a 21st century world?
Well, I think it does, but in a very limited way. I mean, it is not the United Nations. It is not the BRICS. It is not those kind of fora, but in a quiet way, yes, it does a lot of good. I mean, he's by no means the only person who has made, unpleasant things. I mean, Uhuru Kenyatta from Kenya said that Africa must distrust the blandishments of those who've drunk from the poison fountain of imperialism. But I mean, you know, here's a man who really, in essence, is, you know, he's drunk as deep as anyone has, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
But he doesn't like being hauled up before on the human rights issues, which his own country has signed up to. And that is the difficulty. It's a very difficult one, but I don't see it as a breaker.
Thorny issues abound. Martin Indeed. Flout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, thank you very much for joining us this morning here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It is 11:23 in Nairobi, 9:23 in Warsaw, and 8:23 here in London. It's time now to speak to our man in Warsaw, Gulliver Craig. Let's begin on a story you've highlighted for us about Independence Day.
Well, it's Independence Day today in Poland. That's the 11th of November is when they got independence in 1918. But it's a bank holiday, and for years it's been a celebration of sorts, but over the last few years it's increasingly turned into an occasion for the far right to show its colours. They organise a big march in the centre of Warsaw, and last year and the year before that march turned violent. So people are wondering today whether or not that's going to happen again. The far right movement, although it doesn't have any political representation in Poland, it does seem to be getting stronger. This year, earlier, two groups got together and formed a single group called the National Movement. There have been quite a large number of violent incidents this year, not terribly serious violent incidents. Nobody was killed or seriously injured, but sort of smoke bombs on left-wing lectures or attacks on cinemas that were showing films related to LGBT themes, for example. And so there is a sort of feeling that this movement is getting stronger, but it's interesting today to know, it will be interesting to see how many people turn out for the march, because there's a very big difference, which is that this year, the sort of more also nationalist, but more mainstream, more acceptable conservative right-wing party, Law and Justice, led by Jarosław Kaczynski, told people not to go on the far-right march, which he hadn't done in the previous years. So it's going to be a big test this year. It's also a test of the police, whether or not they can manage to have it go off without violence this year.
Tell us more also about the controversial nationalist group, the National Rebirth of Poland, because they're also planning a march.
The National Rebirth of Poland, is that no, that's the march which is going to be in Wrocław. That's a rival group to the two groups which united and formed the national movement and which were organizing the Independence Day march in Warsaw. I think that the National Rebirth of Poland is a more neo-Nazi kind of movement. There are some people who think that it really would have been better if Hitler had won the war, for example. That's what sort of divides them between the from the national movement, the people who are marching in Warsaw.
They famously at a LGBT rights supporters meeting a few years ago chanted "Gas the queers." Nice, but how significant is their support, and will their supporters be out on the streets?
They're much more based in the southwest of Poland, in Wrocław. There's a sort of geographical division. So I think that they'll be on the streets in Wrocław, while the people who will be in Warsaw will be supporting this national movement, which is planning to field candidates, actually, in the European parliamentary elections next year. And there's also, what I've noticed even just this weekend, is that there's quite a strong contingent of far-right nationalists from other European countries, from France, Italy, and particularly, of course, from Hungary, which has quite a long tradition already of sending its nationalists to Poland to join in with their Polish brothers. It seems that this movement is sort of internationalizing, and that Warsaw, because they've got this march, is becoming a bit of a pole for sort of far-right people from all over Europe to come together.
Gulliver, let's move on to another story, a rather interesting story here regarding climate change. Poland will be hosting those set of negotiations this week, but an interesting choice considering Poland has been rather sceptical, I guess, when it comes to climate change in the past.
Well, yes, Poland generates 95% of its electricity from coal. Poland has vetoed EU moves to set stricter emissions targets in the past. And even this COP19 UN summit, they've chosen among their sponsors PGE, the huge utilities company, which operates a large number of coal-fired power stations in Poland. The coal industry, I think, is hoping to take advantage of the fact that this conference is in Poland to lobby for less strict targets and for less to be done, because they're so worried about the effect that it could have on their industry or on the broader economy of Poland if European countries and the wider world is forced to commit to stricter emissions targets. But the ambitions of this COP19 aren't very big. They don't have to come up with a deal or sign any deal this year. They have to prepare for the deal that they might sign in Paris in 2015. And this year, their countries are being invited basically to Warsaw to set out a timetable or a roadmap as to when they might make promises about cutting their CO2 emissions. So they're not even being asked to promise anything. They're just being asked to promise something one day.
Oh, politics. Don't you just love it? Meanwhile, are the nationalists taking any stance on these climate talks?
Yes, they are. They organised an anti-summit or a counter-summit yesterday, which was a one-day event in which they had various climate sceptic scientists to come up and put the case against the IPCC and saying that climate change is either not happening or it's just a natural phenomenon and it's not caused by humans. And their main sort of point about this is they think that it's basically a conspiracy by Western rich countries that want to develop their technology in terms of either nuclear power or wind energy or that kind of thing, hit poor old Poland, which is not rich enough to invest in those kinds of technologies and still dependent on coal. And so they see it as absolutely a nationalist issue and a sort of, Poland must not submit to this dictatorship of the UN and the EU telling us that the planet is in danger just in order. I mean, those are the kinds of things that you could hear yesterday at that summit. There's certainly kind of interesting and also worrying, the way that they're trying to link these two themes. But there were a lot of the foreign nationalists were there in force as well at that event. It was very, very well attended. The room was absolutely packed.
Gulliver, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Our Warsaw correspondent, Gulliver Cragg, many thanks indeed for coming on the show this morning.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be taking a look at the Brazilian front pages with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and we discover an alternative to Turin's contemporary art fair, Artissima, with Paratissima.
But first of all, here is David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. The International Red Cross has described conditions in the Philippines as complete bedlam, as rescue workers struggle to reach areas devastated by Typhoon Haiyan. It's estimated the storm killed 10,000 people and displaced more than 600,000. The storm has now reached central Vietnam, where it has weakened significantly, but several fatalities have been reported. The Western-backed Syrian opposition has agreed to take part in international peace talks in Geneva. The Syrian National Coalition says there are conditions to meet before the talks, including giving relief workers access to besieged areas of Syria. A move to topple the Greek coalition government has been defeated. The no-confidence vote was put forward by the opposition Syriza party in a bid to overturn the austerity policies the government is implementing as a condition of its international bailout. The Maldives top court has delayed holding the second round of the country's presidential election, prolonging the state's political crisis. Mohamed Nasheed, the country's first democratically elected leader, won the first round of voting on Saturday, but failed to win a clear majority. There have been some violent protests as President Mohamed Wahid refused to stand down. The UN's highest court is due to rule on a disputed area of land surrounding the Priya Vihear Temple on the border between Cambodia and Thailand. The long-standing rift has previously led to clashes between the two nations, who both lay claim to the land. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. It's 10:32 in Ramallah, 9:32 in Oslo, 8:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn. And now we are heading to Turin, where last week much of Italy and the international art market's attention was focused on the international art fair Artissima, taking place in the rebuilt and suitably regenerated Lingotto area of this automotive centre.
However, Turin is a city known for doing things a little bit differently. With 5 years under its wing, the fringe event to this year's art fair Paratissimo has already become Italy's most visited contemporary art event. Well, Monocle's David Pleasant caught up with Alessandro Stilo, curator and creative director of Paratissimo, about how young artists might manage to break the current economic deadlock.
Paratissima is the fringe of Artissima, totally independent fringe. That's why the name is Paratissima, something that is not exactly Artissima, but is para, is around, it's at the side of Artissima, and is a totally independent event that offered the opportunity to exhibit to 600 artists, especially from the region, but not only.
And we're here just the other side of the railway tracks across this bridge that was built for the Olympics. We can see Artissima, the other side of the tracks. And when you arrive here, it's a very different feeling, as you've explained. It's a fringe event for predominantly local artists. What are you trying to sell the artists that take part? But what's in it for them?
Well, you know, first of all, Paratissima is an opportunity, nothing more than an opportunity. With €50, £40, you can exhibit your own art. Second, real point is not that you pay, but is that you pay and so you feel that the event is your. It's not an event that some other person organized for you, but the event that you organize. This is, I think, is the big difference from us and Artissima. Our budget is 10%, maybe less, of Artissima. And, I mean, we don't have problem in that sense. We do an exhibition dedicated to the people. At the same time, we have many sections, and in the sections, in the special activities, special projects, there are very good artists, very well-known artists. Starting from this year, we have GAP, that means Galleries at Paratissima, where we have 10 galleries that sell artworks that cost less than 5,000 euro. So it's an offer to young artists, to people that make art.
You mentioned before we were walking around something of the curatorial help, the tuition, that the kind of the school that you're running here, and how fundamentally you might tell the artists, the exhibitors, what to do, but there's no kind of intervention. Everyone's free to do what they want at the end of the day. Would you agree? Is that difficult, that kind of process? You, as somebody involved in the arts, do you find it a challenge to let these people just exhibit however they want? What are the challenges there?
Well, it's really a challenge. Why? Because it's easier to say you must do that. I mean, to be a boss, it's difficult for one side, but it's very easy for the other side. But this is not the philosophy of Paratissima. The idea is to make a point with the artist. They are free to don't follow our suggestion. What we are trying to do is to transform Paratissima in an organized chaos from a chaos. So we don't want to become the best organized event in the world. We want to help the artists to understand what is best for their artworks and for their own. So this is a dialogue. It's very, very challenging. It's very, very tiring, because 600 artists, we are a big staff, but the artistical staff, the artistic direction is 15 people. So we have to discuss with 50, 100 artists each day. But this is how you can build an event with the people, not for the people.
Finally, if we can open up, look outside these walls, this complex, and talk about Turin and Italy and the contemporary art more widely. Italy obviously has a huge presence on the contemporary art scene still, but do you see a disconnect between perhaps the opportunities for young artists, or do you think it's always been a struggle and it always will be? What's the current situation, do you think, if you are a young, aspiring contemporary artist here in Italy? How would you paint that picture?
Well, Italy has a large, huge scene of artists and of young artists. This is a good point. During last 15 years, more than in many other European countries, especially the cities and the regions, dedicated money and activities to offer opportunity to young people to become young artists. This is a good point. Italy hasn't a real art market. Doesn't exist a real large art market. This is not a good point. So, third point, today energy, the money of the local authorities that are very important in Italy. Italy is the country of the 5,000 cities and little town and so on. The money is over. So this is not a good moment, but at the same time, many of the biggest ideas in art became in a crisis moment. Post-war was fantastic for UK, for Italy, for German, for many other countries, for Balkans now. So the problem is the conscious that you have to make your own way.
That was Alessandro Stilo, curator and creative director of Paratissima, speaking to our very own David Pleasant in Turin.
You're listening to Midori House. Still to come, our Brazilian newspaper review. But first, we ask what makes good television in Israel.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Welcome back. It is 10:42 in Helsinki and 8:42 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Time now for a sneak peek of tonight's culture show. TV executives and industry leaders from around the world gathered in Jerusalem last week for the second annual InTV conference. It's an international event organized by the country's Keshet Media Group, the brains behind Prisoners of War, a hugely successful show which was remade for an American audience under the new title Homeland.
You said you had information about an attack by Abu Nazir.
I have information.
Prove it.
The guards. They are coming.
Please, we're out of time.
An American prisoner of war has been returned.
He said this in English.
Yes, he whispered it into my ear right before the guards pulled me away.
The two-day event featured speakers from across the TV industry and is designed to keep up with the latest innovations in this rapidly evolving world. But it's also a chance to showcase Israel's TV and media community. And it perhaps comes as no surprise that many of the guests attending were on the lookout for the new homeland. Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast Magazine, was there, and he stopped by Midori House earlier to speak to producer Katie Bilboa about the TV shows being highlighted at this year's event for the new edition of The Culture Show.
The direct translation of the Hebrew is yellow peppers, and apparently that's what the couple in the show grow. But in the UK, it's being called the A word, which it probably makes a little bit more sense. It's a family drama about this extremely talented kid, an extremely talented musician, but the parents find out that he's autistic, and it's how they deal with it. And yeah, it doesn't necessarily have the same punch as a sort of spy drama, but when you watch the episode, and I've seen the first episode, and it's a really good show, it's been made really well. And so yeah, it's coming over here. Channel 4 is developing at the moment in an English language version.
לא, אתה גאון.
איזה קסם.
ילד מיוחד.
כן, גאון.
גאון.
איזה קסם.
The thing about this show is that it's quite funny, and while it deals with these sensitive subjects, it was created by a woman called Karen Margalit, whose child is autistic. But the thing is, it's not a wallowing show. It's not about despair. It's basically just a sort of quite a funny, uplifting drama about the family and how they cope with it. It's not sad at all.
So tell me about some of these other shows that are being touted as the potential next Homeland.
Yeah, so there's a few more sort of more action-based shows that are a little bit more like Homeland. The big one that a lot of people talking out that they haven't really announced yet is a show called The Dig. In fact, being written by Gideon Raff, who is the creator of Prisoners of War Homeland. And he's writing it with a guy called Tim Kring, who created Heroes a few years ago and Touch with Kiefer Sutherland. And in fact, Tim was out in TV to talk about the project and talk about his sort of general involvement in this world. And it's a mystery drama, and it's actually being filmed in Jerusalem, or they're looking to film it in Jerusalem. And there's not that many more details known about it, but it's the type of thing that you can see matching the sort of experience of someone like Tim Kring, who created Heroes, with the guy who created Homeland. Is just a fantastic proposal. So that's one. That's what a lot of people were talking about. There's another one called Mice, which is in Israel is known as the Godan cell. And that's a bit more of a traditional spy drama. So that's one that a few people are certainly looking at. In fact, NBC is developing at the moment, and we might see that next year on screens in the States.
Okay.
Let's move on, because it's not just dramas that people were looking at while they were in TV. Comedy is something that's coming through a bit as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's not something you'd necessarily hear about, Israeli comedy, but there were two in particular that really caught my eye in TV. There was one called She's With Me, which is this story of a Israeli supermodel who decides that this sort of local baker, this guy who's never travelled outside of Israel, will become her boyfriend and travel with her around the world. And it's a really sort of fish out of water story. And that was really, really quite interesting to watch. And I think a few people sort of caught that and thought that might be something that we can see around the world.
And what are the odds that she will fit into his family?
It's funny. I mean, yeah. It is funny. And it's also, it's like a trailer for a rom-com film.
Exactly. It's a rom-com with a slightly bit more heart, or certainly a little bit more to it than perhaps your sort of average Jennifer Aniston rom.
And just finally, we've got to talk about Rising Star. This is a reality TV format, which is coming out of Israel at the moment. Having watched part of it, I'm slightly confused as to how it differentiates from other reality TV wannabe pop star formats, but maybe you can just explain what the show is.
Definitely. I was a bit cynical going into this. There'd been lots of talk in the last few weeks and months, and particularly at MIPCOM, which is the last time I came in to talk to you, lots of people talking about Rising Star. And it sounded on paper very much like Idols or X Factor. And they took us to a taping of it just outside of Jerusalem. And it was, you know, you walk into the big studio where there's the guy, the good-looking guy in the nice shirt singing a traditional pop song, and your girl belting out a big sort of Whitney Houston number. But there's this element of technology to it whereby all of the viewers are putting this in through an app on their phones and deciding which one of the two contestants is going to go through. And when you're watching it on this big screen, the numbers are flashing up, so you can actually see in real time who the public likes, and the performer can see who the public likes as well, maybe, but you know, helping them to improve or try and do something to get their, help their situation.
I think situation. It could be a little distracting.
But perhaps, exactly. But there was two in particular. There was, as I said, there was, you know, your traditional stock boy band type members, but there was a collection of guys called the Amazing Rabbis, two, you know, traditional Jewish men dressed in traditional garb, and they were belting out Simon and Garfunkel numbers and a version of Hotel California, which is something definitely you have to see to be believed. On a dark desert highway, cool wind in my hair,
warm smell of colitas rising up. And that was Peter White there talking to producer Katie there about the InTV conference in Jerusalem. Now, to hear more about that report, plus a session from Slade Cleaves and reports from Artissima Turin, Art Taipei, and much, much more, tune into Culture with Robert Bound tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours if you're listening to us on the East Coast of Canada and the United States.
In just a moment, we'll be leafing through the Brazilian front pages with Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. But first, to get us there, here's a song by what can only be described as the Brazilian icon, Roberto Carlos. This is O Calambeque.
Essa é uma das muitas histórias que acontecem comigo. Primeiro foi Suzy, quando eu tinha lambreta. Depois comprei carro. Bye. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Well, if that didn't brighten up your Monday morning wherever you are in the world, then I think there's no hope for you. That was, of course, Brazilian singer Roberto Carlos, and the song was O Kayembek.
Well, another Brazilian now joining us in the studio with as big as a smile as probably Roberto is our Monocle's researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
The song made me smile, actually.
Did it?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about Roberto and that song.
Well, actually, he's in the news. I will talk to him about him anyway. Roberto Carlos is like a Brazilian national icon, you know. And actually, for example, you know, we talk about Christmas tradition. A Christmas tradition in Brazil is to watch the special Roberto Carlos concert. It's every day on the 25th of December, people watch TV to see he's playing his Christmas songs or even O Kayembek as well, which is a lovely, lovely song.
And why is he in the news?
Well, let's talk about the story on O Globo. You know, in Brazil, there's a polemic about the publication of non-authorized biographies. Because in terms of publication of non-authorized biographies, Brazil is very strict. It's definitely not like the UK or the US, which is quite open. I mean, you can publish biographies even if it's not authorized. And Roberto Carlos was a very famous case, like back in 2008, when he managed to make the publisher stop printing his non-authorized biography, because he's a very kind of a private person as well. So even though he's extremely famous, he's not in the magazines all the time, so people don't know much about his private life. So because of that, he went to court and he won. But now there's this big debate in Brazil about this publication of, and all the major musicians in Brazil, they created a group to discuss that. And it's an interesting topic, but it's been every day on the press. And now they're fighting among each other, because now Roberto Carlos said that actually he's in favor of the publication of those biographies. But how he can say that if he stopped the publication of one back in 2008? So for me, they're behaving like misbehaved children in the playground, in a way.
And
so,
what about the Brazilian people? Are they in favor? Do they want to see these unauthorized biographies hit the bookshelves?
I think they do. And I think it's not being very good for their image in a way, this whole discussion. Because even, for example, I think I mentioned this before, Veja, which is the best-selling magazine in Brazil, 3 million copies every week. They did a very damaging cover saying that, because some of those artists, they were persecuted during the dictatorship in Brazil. So how they can be pro-censorship now? So it's a bit weird what's happening in Brazil at the moment. And even the front page of Um Globo say, between kisses and slaps, which is the name of another famous Brazilian song, which I can play next week, maybe. So they're all fighting with each other.
Let's move over to Sao Paulo. An interesting story about a cultural shift in the way that Brazilians can take their holidays.
Exactly. And I'm kind of happy about that, because usually there's in Brazil, people take the whole month off. They have 30 days and they take, okay, I'll take July off or January off. But and the law also say that you can do like 10 days and then 20 days. But now I think companies are becoming more flexible, I would say a more kind of European style of taking holidays. So they're dividing between three terms of 10 days. So I think it's much better for someone. I know that when you take a lot of days in a row, you kind of rest a bit more. Mm. But at the same time, imagine if you have a wedding or an event. I remember when I was working in Brazil, it was definitely not like here in Europe, where you can say, oh, I'll take this Friday off and then, you know, that Monday off. So it's quite strict, you know.
So how it is now, people can take a month off and then they essentially have to work almost 11 months straight, pretty much.
Absolutely. Well,
a couple holidays.
Exactly. Like holidays. We do have a couple of holidays, you know. Every month we have like one or two.
And you'll take the whole World Cup, the whole country will just take that special holiday.
Talking about that, there's been some controversy in schools and companies saying, what are we going to do when Brazil is playing? Because usually it's a holiday, but now Brazil wants to show this image of a serious country. So they're saying, no, actually, we're going to still be working.
Oh, no, but the world would be so let down if Brazil didn't
take that seriously.
There's another story in the Folha de São Paulo, Fernando, which I know you and I can probably relate to quite a bit. It talks about people's habits when they go out at night.
Well, yeah, they did this.
This is a morning show, gentlemen.
I'm already looking forward to Friday evening.
They did this big study in the nightlife in São Paulo, because, you know, the club scene in São Paulo is really good, I have to say. You know, any day you want to go out, you know, and bars stay open until 6 a.m., 7 a.m. So that's a
good
thing. Yeah, I've heard. Of course, never experienced that. But so basically 56% of people who go to those nightclubs, they say that they go there to get drunk. That was the main...
Stop the press.
Stop
Surely
the press.
Not.
But then there's an interesting thing, because the Brazilian law, I don't know if I told you guys this before, is very severe when you drink alcohol and you drive at the same time. So basically, if you have a single drop of alcohol in your system, basically, the police can take your driving license. So I remember when I was living in São Paulo, let's say if I have just one pint or something, you know, sometimes I had to stay in a little hotel, you know, to before going home, because I couldn't
drive.
Then why
were you driving in the first place if you knew you were going to a bar?
That was probably my...
You wouldn't take the public transport.
That's another problem. That's another problem. The public transport in São Paulo is not that good. And it's not like, I wouldn't say it's like proper 24 hour, which is a shame for such a big city.
So and people, kind of vital if your bars are going to stay open till 6, you need your public transport.
And especially if you're thinking to get a little bit tipsy as well.
So. But I guess it can be helpful to have that spare room or something close by.
Yeah, but you never know. And then that's another thing, if I can tell you guys, you know, in Brazil we have this something called love hotels, right? Which is, I mean, I know the ideal for those hotels is to do something else, but then they're very cheap as well. So you can find those kind of love hotels for a very cheap rate every corner. I know it's
right,
interesting.
No, but again, you've heard.
Save it for the weekend.
even in the World Cup, now they're selling those bedrooms for normal tourists, you know, right, instead of what they do usually.
Faye, very quickly, just give us your last story, also from Sao Paulo, very speedily.
Absolutely. Big fighting between our previous mayor and the current mayor. Fernando Haddad, he did an investigation on the previous term of Gilberto Kassab, and actually they arrested some of Kassab's former aides because of corruption. So basically now they're fighting. Today's on the front page of Folha de São Paulo, basically Kassab is defending that actually Haddad... in Haddad's government, there's corruption as well. So I'm sure we're going to hear much more about those two.
Excellent stuff. Thanks very much, Fernando. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there with the Brazilian front pages. And if you want any more of his love hotel tips, just send him an email at fp@monocle.com.
Oh, I can't believe we did that. Sadly, that is all we have time for today. You can love bomb any of us if you want. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, you know how to get hold of him, and Maria Rouge, and our studio manager, Alex Funnel. Up next after the headlines is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York. But from now, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dared men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.